In 1997, two strangers walked into a science lab to participate in an experiment, and about an hour later, they walked out in love. A year later, they were married. Psychologist Arthur Aaron and his wife Elaine, they were intending to study whether or not they could accelerate interpersonal bonding. Could you cultivate closeness that would typically take years? And after many of these such trials, it turns out the answer is a resounding yes, you can. if you don't believe me, these findings have been replicated over and over again by them and others, not always resulting in romantic love, of course, but even participants who had nothing in common or opposing ideologies or expected the experiment not to work for them reported that afterwards they felt a deep affection and appreciation for their counterpart. How is this happening?
We're going to do this today.
Yeah, we're all going to pair up. So pick someone you really like, or maybe don't, right? So this series, we're talking about the gifts of Christmas, and this week we're talking about love. Last week we talked about hope, not the kind of hope that's like, I wish this will happen, I hope this will happen, and not the kind of hope that you have to be lucky, but it's the kind of hope that we know that God can be trusted, and we put our hope in that. That is our hope. This week, we're talking about love. What is the gift that Christmas gives of love? Today, as a gift to you, I'm going to teach all of you how to fall in love with a stranger. Isn't that what you want? Some of you may have heard about this study. In 2015, it became really popular when a New York Times writer experimented with this and their colleague, and they fell in love and got married.
That's dangerous.
Yeah. So this got very popularized when she wrote about her experience. Here's the method. You ready? According to Arthur and Elaine, you pair up willing participants, which is key. You have to have willing participants, and you sit them face to face, and as they are looking at each other, they are taking turns asking each other 36 predetermined questions, and each question is increasingly personal. For example, some of the earlier questions are ones that we ask at parties, like, who, living or dead, would you like to invite to a dinner party? Or describe what your perfect day would be like. And then they each take turns listening and answering. But some of the later ones are like, what is your best and most terrible memory? When did you last cry in front of someone? And when did you last cry by yourself? Throughout the 36 questions, it also asks you to ask your partner, what three things do you and your partner seem to have in common? And you're strangers, so just based on that brief interaction you've been having, you try to think about, how are we similar? And then it also asks to name three things that you appreciate about your partner. So remember, these are strangers, so you're going to have to be paying attention. And the last question is to share a personal problem with your partner and ask their advice on how they might handle it. And then also ask your partner to reflect back to you how you seem to be feeling about that problem. You can find these questions, all 36 questions, online. BuzzFeed loves these kinds of things. So it's all over the internet. But when they completed all 36 questions. They then, still sitting facing each other, were supposed to hold eye contact for 4 minutes. Wow. That's a very long time. Because I've just been bouncing around for like about a second each, and it's a little bit uncomfortable. But you can see how this would accelerate bonding. It's mutual vulnerability. It's deep listening. You are practicing taking each other's perspectives. You're physically in close proximity to each other. You're exchanging affirmations, giving and receiving considerate feedback, and yes, a lot of eye contact. I don't think that the actions of this study are surprising. This is how we treat our loved ones. This is how we should treat our loved ones, is having this kind of attention and care in our conversations and the way that we interact. When I'm people watching, as I do a lot when I'm writing a sermon at a coffee shop, I can tell who in the room loves each other. We know what love looks like. It doesn't even have to be romantic love. You see two friends, and one is leaning in, listening to every word of the story that their other friend is sharing. Or you see two people having a hard conversation, and they're touching each other compassionately or exchanging comforting words. We know love when we see it. So let's shift gears a little bit. And we're going to talk about Jesus now. On the day that Jesus was born, the world changed forever. And this is not a religious claim. It's a historical fact. On every single list that I found of history's most influential people, Jesus is the number one at the top of the list. It's hard to name an element of human life that Jesus and Jesus' teachings hasn't affected. Today, we are highlighting love. And Jesus completely redefined love. When you see a stranger who's suffering, who may be suffering from any manner of things, right? Does that make you feel good inside? Oh, I'm glad that's not me. Yeah, tough for that guy, but you know, glad it's not me. Why does that not give you a warm, fuzzy feeling when you see someone else suffering? If you have a difficult coworker who has a loved one die, do you celebrate that they're suffering? The reason that this is like gross, ooh, why would anyone feel that way, is because of Jesus. Jesus expanded the circle of who we are expecting people to love and feel compassion for. Before Jesus, it was perfectly normal and socially acceptable to pray for God to do bad things to your enemies. Yeah. Psalm 59. Psalm 59 is a prayer of David against his enemies. Let's see. He is asking God to consume them and surround them with wrath, but don't kill them, so that they may be like stray dogs wandering around the outskirts of the city, howling and searching for food. Yikes. That feels gross. And the reason that it feels gross to you and I is because of Jesus. You see, it is natural and beneficial to act lovingly towards our family and our kin, to look out for their interests because you can expect them to do the same to you. But Jesus taught that we should cultivate love and loving kindness towards strangers and our enemies. And that was novel. And that was strange. in Jesus' words of Luke 6. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good things to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those whom you expect to be repaid, what credit is that? Even sinners lend and expect a full repayment. But love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. This is the kind of love that is a gift to the world. It was a gift the world needed and didn't have. And on Christmas, this is the kind of love that Jesus brought to the world. You know the phrase Christmas spirit? The invisible thing that inspires generosity and good deeds. That is this kind of love. The spirit of Christmas causes people to think about others, to give generously to strangers, to participate in random acts of kindness. And we hope as Christians to cultivate that kind of Jesus love towards others all year round. But culturally, it's very appropriate during this time of year to think about the person who you don't know, who may have less than you. Jesus redefined love, and the world has never been the same. Another important gift that Christmas brings is Christmas redefined God. Think historically about ideas of what a god or gods were like. The Greek deities were often depicted as sadist bullies, itching for excuses to inflict suffering upon the less powerful, and they got a kick out of doing it. Even the slightest wrong would bring divine wrath. And it could be assumed that the unfortunate would experience more and more punishment because they were weak. I was going to bring up a couple of examples of these, but they were too horrible to describe. But that's not the prominent view of God now. And why is that? Now we expect people's God to be good, people's God to be kind and benevolent. Because according to Christmas, God is not a being that needs to be appeased. God is not a distant, angry being waiting for us to mess up. According to Christmas, God does not relate in quid pro quo. And what we just read in John 1, it says, God is love. That is a shocking redefinition of God. This is how God showed love among us. God sent his Son into the world that we might have life through him. According to Christmas, God is leaning in, coming near, is exposed to mutual vulnerability, deep listening, perspective taking, physical proximity, exchanging affirmations, giving and receiving considerate feedback, and a lot of eye contact. According to Christmas, God is love, and God is in love with you. Even when we are strangers, God is cultivating love towards us. So how are we to give and receive this type of Christmas love as a gift? I said before, we know love when we see it. That's not the hard part. The tricky part about love is that it's both a feeling and a way of behaving. What I think is great about this study that the Aarons did is it's not some super special list of questions that makes you able to, like, cast a love spell on a stranger. Because we know what love looks like. We know how to do these things. The thing that is interesting to me about this study is which comes first, the doing or the feeling. These people were strangers, and they acted in a loving way, and they cultivated affection and compassion. You can cultivate affection and compassion towards a stranger, towards someone that you have conflicting ideologies with. That is the encouraging thing about love. If you aren't feeling it, it's okay. Here's a list of 36 questions that you can work through. But you can also just have this imaginary conversation with a person where you're sitting and thinking about what they would answer to these hard, difficult questions. You can cultivate compassion just by having an imaginary conversation where you're stepping into their shoes and picturing what it would be like to be them. I have two things, though, that I want to talk about, because you might be thinking, but I don't have that to give right now. You can't pour from an empty cup. You might say that sounds too hard and it's too much. A really important thing about this study that they did is the mutual vulnerability piece. The sharing the hard stuff too. It's okay in conversations with people that are either your loved ones or people that you're trying to love, but it might be hard. It's okay to be honest about your limitations. It's okay to have a conversation about, this is how much I have to give right now. Because even in that conversation, you are opening yourself up to give and receive compassion in that moment. You're able to say to that person, this is how much I have. I wish I had more, but I don't. And that's a loving thing to do, is to set those expectations. You can't give what you don't have. Another part of the scripture that we read said, we love because God first loved us. In the Christian context that I grew up in, it was really common to have what we called a quiet time. And it can become kind of legalistic of how, like, oh, I had an hour-long quiet time in the morning and at night. That's really a lot of free time that you should be grateful for having. But but the thing, right, the thing about this idea is that it's a time in your day that you are stepping back to refill the love tank, right? You are engaging in these spiritual practices that fill you up and enables you to have something to give. Taking these breaks refills our ability to be compassionate and loving. So praying for people is an act of perspective taking. You can cultivate love and compassion because you are imagining what they are going through. So we need to take time to cultivate love in ourselves so that we have anything to give away. And I wanted to give you just one more encouraging thing about cultivating love. It's back to the science-y type stuff. When you love someone, a few things are happening in your brain. There's a release of a handful of different hormones, and they give you feedback, and they make you feel good and good about the person and good about the way that you're acting. And when you love someone and do loving things, you have more of these good feeling hormones. Specifically, oxytocin. Does anyone in the room know what oxytocin is famous for? Yeah, childbirth. You get a flood of oxytocin during childbirth because you need it. You need it. It is pain relieving. Maybe not enough, but it literally reduces the pain of a difficult experience. So when you are experiencing love for someone, your brain has more oxytocin, which is literally reducing how hard it is to do something nice for somebody else. When we are trying to do something hard or selfless, loving them makes that easier, makes that feel better. So, in the end, all that we want from Christmas is to receive this good gift of love. Amen. To receive it and to have something to give. Because as this passage in John said, we are Jesus in the world.